Hey, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to this week's message. My name's Aaron, and I'm on the staff team here at Eastlake. Everything we do around here depends on the generous donations of our local and online community, people just like you, who tune into these messages and see great benefit from living that idea that life is a gift and love is the point. So if you love what Eastlake is up to, we'd encourage you to contribute by going to eastlakecc.com. With that, let's jump into this week's message.
Today we are continuing our series, You Manifesto, where we're talking about looking at primarily the teachings of Jesus, but specifically asking the question, how does this help us to become more human? Beneficial presences in the world. We've been in the Beatitudes, and this week we're talking blessed are the peacemakers. So would you welcome one of our very own member here at the church, Kyle Reynolds. Come on, let's hear it.
Take it away, brother. Hey, everyone. It's good to see you guys again. I get extra giddy when I get to share with our community because you've changed me. You really have over these. I don't know how long it's been as for Laura and I and our kids to be a part of this community. It's just been a beautiful journey together. So thanks for how you've impacted us. Really, we're looking at. The Bible today, and I realize that because of the diversity of our church, and I'll come back to that again later, I love the diversity of our church, that when we look at passages in the scriptures, that it's easy to potentially have some hang-ups or some filters that come up in our minds. And I love how Kent Dobson, I think maybe a couple years ago, framed this, and it stuck with me all this time, that oftentimes it's easy to, did that actually happen? Did some guy, some Galilean carpenter from 2,000 years ago actually get up on a mountain and say these phrases, and then many, many years later, actually, people wrote it down and they got it all correct? But perhaps maybe a more compelling question is, not did it happen, but is it happening? And I think these passages are very much happening in our world today. Another way that Kent frames it is, whether or not it's true, sure, but perhaps could it be more than true? And this passage we'll look at today, I believe, helps us to be human. I think it's more than true. I think it's happening in our world. And so the saying that we'll look at today from Jesus is, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God." And when I think of peace, I mainly go to like an inner tranquility, a peace of mind, perhaps, the absence of war. I think of a central point or a period, a tiny inward point of tranquility. I think of this quote, "Weekends are a bit like rainbows. They look good from a distance, but disappear when you get up close to them." But I think that's not actually what Jesus is talking about, potentially. I think that's, instead of peacemaking, that's more peace-seeking. That it's somewhere off in the distance. It's waiting until Friday night, or it's working for the weekend. It's waiting for vacation. It's that perfect Instagram pic of your toes and the tangerine sun on the beach with the Mai Tai. And like, you pose it. Like, it's, that was funnier than I thought it was going to be. Nail it. And we'll keep that for Doug. Okay, in relationships, Michelle Weiner Davis breaks down relationships in these five stages, and it's stuck with my wife and I over these 15 years of marriage. But it goes for any relationship. Stage one would be kind of the honeymoon phase, right? That everything they do is perfect. I've never learned anything bad about them. I'm not meaning to mock this, although I just did. What I'm trying to convey is, this is a very necessary and important, don't skip the step. This is a beautiful part of any relationship. But then it inevitably gets to stage two. It's the "what was I thinking" stage. It's the disillusionment, right? That where reality sets in, you watch them floss their teeth. You know, you notice how loud they chew. It's this "what was I thinking" stage. And then that gives way to stage three, which is the "everything would be great if," right? Everything would be great if we could just go back to stage one. Everything would be great if he or she would just stop that one thing, that you fixate in on that thing. If we can just eliminate that, then we could go back. And ultimately, this is kind of this false nostalgia because they weren't perfect in stage one and they're not perfect in stage three. It's this false looking back, this peace seeking. And frankly, it's MAGA. It's make America great again. As if America was really great back before women could vote, or America was really great back when we had separate water fountains. I mean, exactly when was America great for, right? This is false nostalgia. America wasn't perfect then. America isn't perfect now. And it's this peace seeking that oftentimes I default to, at least for sure. And then it brings me to another way of looking at potentially peace. Instead of peace seeking, I start to think of peace as a straight line, right? That there's no fluctuation in it. It's even keel. It's keeping the status quo. Martin Luther King Jr. said this powerful quote, "The Negro's great stumbling block in the stride towards freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice." You see, this view of peace is actually peacekeeping, right? It's the absence of conflict. It's where there's no fluctuation. Peacekeeping is very polite. And in Seattle, we're like experts at that, right? We're the ideal seatmate on an airplane where we like say, get your name, and then we go back to our book we're just very great at being polite. We'll let you cross the crosswalk, but don't invite me over for dinner. Like we're intimately, I didn't mean to go this way, but our intimacy is oftentimes stunted. Maybe I can come full circle. Peacekeeping maintains the status quo. It's putting away the alcohol before the religious in-laws come over. It's unfriending someone you disagree with on Facebook. In relationships, right, we had those three stages. We had the honeymoon, the disillusionment phase, and then finally everything would be great if we could go back, right? This would be at that fork in the road where you don't choose this nostalgia. Instead, you choose this sweeping conflict under the rug. It's keeping up appearances. It's resigning yourself that I guess life's just going to be like this moving forward. It's maybe a decision to begin living separate lives. Peacekeeping can oftentimes look like conformity or complicity or even compliance. And when we reach this fork in the road of these two, I think, bad options, I love in this passage that we are invited into a different vision of peace. Without peace-seeking and peacekeeping, because ultimately, those two ideas of peace are problematic because they offer a limited perspective. It doesn't actually move the world forward at all. It's my peacekeeping shopping spree that encourages fast fashion. So the real cost of that $5 shirt at Old Navy is exploited workers and contaminated rivers somewhere else in the world. It's when it comes to peacekeeping, it's the sit-ins in the 1960s where police used water cannons and dogs to maintain order. They were seen as keeping the peace from unruly college students. It's currently we have pastors and Christian nonprofit leaders who are secretly LGBTQ affirming but unwilling to go public to not rock the boat. Now, I'm not suggesting that we become like these like really argumentative, ultra-confrontational people, okay? I don't want to be a jerk. Like, I don't think that's what this passage is inviting us into, this I'm not suggesting we all should just cancel our vacations. What I'm suggesting potentially is that this passage is inviting us into this refreshing, different understanding of peace. That is a third way. The word is this word shalom, which was mentioned earlier by Ryan. And it's this idea that all things are made whole, that we're living out our fullest potential, this comprehensive welfare, a holistic justice, communal well-being in every direction and in every relation. Dr. Dale Bruner describes it as a circle, that the person in the center is related justly to every point on the circumference of the circle, embracing community inwardly and outwardly, a just reconciliation of all things, neighbor, enemy, oppressed, oppressor, oceans, forests, coral, the air we breathe. Shane Claiborne, I think, puts it magnificently. He says, peacemaking doesn't mean passivity. It is the act of interrupting injustice without mirroring injustice. The act of disarming evil without destroying the evildoer. The act of finding a third way that is neither fight nor flight, but the careful, arduous pursuit of reconciliation and justice. It is about a revolution of love that is big enough to set both the oppressed and the oppressors free. See, the circle is continually warped, so the work of a peacemaker is to round it out. Martin Luther King Jr. again said this. He goes, "It is a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he should lift himself up by his bootstraps. It is even worse to tell a man to lift himself up by his own bootstraps when somebody else is standing on the boot." See, peacemaking is about confronting unjust structures and inequality in our world. Where peacekeeping was polite, peacemaking is honest. Where peacekeeping is complicity, peacemaking is compassion. Where we had willful ignorance, we now look towards a subversive civil disobedience. And back to the relationships, right? Those five stages that I keep coming back to. We had stage one is honeymoon, stage two is disillusionment, stage three in any relationship is everything would be great if we could go back. And then we reach this fork in the road, right? And there's a potential third way in relationships where we come to terms with our differences, where we are able to develop a real sense of empathy about the other, where annoyances could even become things we appreciate, and intimacy is born, like true, meaningful, rich intimacy. And this goes far beyond just your relationship with your significant other. This is relationship with the planet, relationship with our neighbor and enemy. It's the difference between uniformity and unity. Just last week, during that meet and greet time, I met this guy, Matt, and he was first time visiting, and he mentioned how diverse, right away off the top, how diverse our community is. And I loved that because no one's impressed with a community of people that like all talk the same and look the same and act the same and vote the same and think the same and believe the same, and they get along. Wow, that's like so amazing that you guys like really like, no one's impressed by that. But what is impressive, I think, what could be inspiring or compelling as a community of people that don't look the same and act the same or even believe the same or think the same or vote the same, and yet they're united amidst their diversity. And a core idea that life is a gift and love is the point. That we need each other to become a beneficial presence in the world. I can't do that by myself. I need help. We need a lot of people to carry that idea forward, to see this world continue to grow and evolve.
Everyone, excuse the interruption for a quick minute. My name is Kristen. I'm one of the team members here at Eastlake, and we're so glad that you're joining us today on the podcast. It's been so encouraging for us to hear stories from people all over the country and the world who are listening to these messages and resonating with this idea that we just keep saying over and over again, which is life is a gift and love is the point, and that we are all committed to being a beneficial presence in our own communities. So thanks for joining us. I hope that that's resonating with you. It's just really fun for us. So wanted to also say thank you to those of you who contribute. This place, all of these things that we do are happening because of people who make consistent, even just small consistent gifts. It helps us plan. It helps us know that there are really people behind us who want this thing to continue. So thank you to those of you who do that. If you haven't had a chance to give yet, I would encourage you to maybe think about doing that if you find this beneficial in your own life. To make a contribution, it's really easy. You can go to eastlakecc.com, and there's a donate button there with all the info. So thanks so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the message.
It's another difference would be like the silver rule versus the golden rule. We've heard of the golden rule, right? To treat others the way you want to be treated. oftentimes for me, I default to the silver rule, that don't treat others the way you do not want to be treated. And on face value, it's really easy to default to that because, like, I can go through in my whole day, I can drive to work and not run anyone over and think, oh, like, I nailed it. You know, I didn't do any harm to others the way I didn't want to be harmed. And on its face value, it's appealing because there's a sense of passivity or neutrality, but I've also found that it can lead to a sense of apathy as well. It creates kind of that bystander effect, right? Where you're seeing someone get mugged. I've never seen someone get mugged, but let's say potentially we all watch someone get mugged. We're all looking at each other to assume that someone else is going to step forward and do something about it. And then no one does anything because everyone thinks someone else is going to do something. Peacemaking is doing something. I love the GenerationHope.com. We're going to go do something. You know, we're moving this forward. We're trying to be implementers of change in our world, trying to live out the golden rule, and for me, not defaulting to a silver rule. I think a story that reminds me of this is this story where Jesus comes into this temple and he starts turning over tables and gets this whip. I always like to think of like what happened before that. Was he, I imagine in my brain, like, he's walking up to the temple on this dirt road, and there's this nice family of four, a dad, a mom, and two kids, and they're like walking up, and they have their sacrifice. You need a sacrifice because you need to appease, in their mind, this God that was angry with you potentially. And so they're bringing this, they're trying to obey, but it's coming from a really sweet place of like, we're going to go worship. We're going to try to connect with the divine. This is important to bring meaning and purpose. And so they're doing this due diligence of walking this sacrifice up to the temple, and Jesus is just kind of observing everything. And they get to the temple, and they go in, and they stand in line. And when they get to the front of the line, they're informed, well, you actually don't have the right animal. You need a temple animal. You need a really, really good animal. So they get in another line, and they relinquish, and they decide, sure, we'll purchase that animal instead. We traveled all this way. Let's just go ahead and do that. And they get to the front of the line, and they're notified that you can't purchase this animal. By the way, it's really expensive. Like, it's exorbitant amounts more than what you spent for your animal. But you can't even pay for this animal because you don't have the right currency. So you need to go get in this other line to exchange your money for the temple money. And so they go and they get into that third line, and they're standing in line. They get to the front of the line, and they go to give their money, what little they have, because they're an oppressed and marginalized group already. And they hand it over, and they say, well, the exchange rate is not going to even cut it. You're not even going to get close to affording the animal you need to make. And at that point, I like to imagine Jesus just lost his shit. Like, I imagine him just saying, enough, enough. And he just starts flipping over tables, and he gets this whip, and he drives people out, and he makes this statement. He goes, my house should be a house of prayer, but you have made it into a den of thieves. Like, he's just fed up. And what I'm taken most by is that those rules of exploitation placed on that family, that didn't even affect him. Like, it wasn't his burden to carry. And I have found like a real significant, I found how it's really significantly encouraging to people when I notice a load that I don't have to carry. Like, for years, I wouldn't say anything because I thought, well, like, I don't want to virtue signal or mansplain or whitesplain. Like, who am I to talk to that issue of oppression or exploitation? Or, like, I don't deal with that personally. And I think there's a real sense of potential arrogance in that, like, I'm going to be a voice for the voiceless. Like, we all have voices. Like, my idea of advocacy is that I step aside and I listen and then I echo and I amplify, but I do not need to speak for. And I have noticed it's tremendously encouraging to people to say that, like, I noticed the burden that you're carrying and it's not okay. Whether it comes to the Me Too movement or systemic racism, to say that I'll stand with you and I'll keep pointing attention to that and I'll keep standing with you. until that burden is no more. That I will no longer be complicit in my own privilege, and I'll no longer benefit from unjust systems. See, I think peace must include a sense of justice, but not like a punitive justice or a vindictive kind of justice, but a restorative kind of justice. Not a justice without consequences, but always aimed at restoring shalom. And it doesn't escape me that today's Veterans Day. Thanks, Ryan, for that. But I'll begin by letting others speak for me when it comes to this. Thomas Merton says, "When I pray for peace, I pray not only that the enemies of my country may cease to want war, but above all that my own country will cease to do the things that make war inevitable." I also want to mention that the sacrifice of military veterans have made it possible for me even to share right now. But also, holding that intention, there are 9 of 196 countries that own nuclear weapons. And the U.S. owns about half of all nuclear weapons in the world. We're the only country to drop them on a civilian population. And so I'm taken by the idea that this passage, "Blessed are the persecuted," that the one that's following this, comes right after "Blessed are the peacemakers" to remind us that peace should not come at any cost. That is countercultural, what's being said here. Because in our framework, I would completely assume that blessed would be the victors or the warmongers or the winners or the peacekeepers. But this is a third way of living, or as Stan said last week, a third naivete. There's this fork in the road where we can choose to look back and everything would be great if, or we can choose to sweep it under the rug and resign ourselves. I guess this is the way it's going to be. I do this with the environment all the time. Like, I guess I default to, like, I guess we're just all effed and it's just not going to work. I mean, you know, but potentially there's a third way of living in this world that's the way of peacemaking. So I want to share like a practical way that's helped me quite a bit of living out this third way, and it's Haidt's universal ethics. It's this theory that every human being in the world has 5 universal ethics, that we all have them, okay? That's important to note. And these ethics, in no order whatsoever, are care, fairness, loyalty, authenticity, or another way of looking at it is respect, and the 5th one is purity or sanctity. Now, here's the clincher, okay? Although every human being has these 5 ethics, the order of those ethics look vastly different for each of us. And therein lies where we have a lot of disagreements and tensions, right? As you've already probably discovered, loyalty for me is not my top ethic, right? It's probably closer to the bottom. I'm going to really have care towards the top. But someone might hear me talk about our country and assume that I'm not patriotic because my loyalty is towards the bottom of the ethics. It's still in there. I just don't weight it as heavily as some other potential ethics. And conversely, I could accuse someone else and be like, how come you don't care about refugees? And in their mind, they're like, well, I have a loyalty to my next-door neighbor as well, too, and they make this equivalency. That could or could not be accurate. But what I've discovered is that because of this differing order of ethics, that it's helped me immensely in conversations with people that have a different order than me. Because I try to figure out what their order is, and I try to enter conversations in that order. Or as like Bart Campola said like a few months ago, like to come at people with their strongest point, not their weakest. And I am like an expert at taking strawman arguments, but it's not helpful. It's not constructive. It doesn't move the world forward at all. And at the very least, it's not like I've used this in a weird manipulative way that this is how I'm going to win this argument, is I'm going to tackle your strong. No, it's more that I like to think that the other that has a different order than I do sees a desire in me for compassion and a desire to learn and to understand, and that we could walk away from the conversation closer, not necessarily agreeing, but closer than we were beforehand. That maybe it moves us closer to a sense of unity and away from uniformity. to appreciate one another's differences, to get through that third stage in any relationship onto something better when we approach that fork in the road. Otherwise, I think the option for me is peacemaking can just become vilifying, right? Like I'll give you my own personal example of this, is I'm under the impression that Trump is racist. At the very least, racists think he's racist. But here's the important thing, I'm haunted by what happens inside of me when I say that, because it gets me off the hook. You know, I found someone worse off than I am in that particular area. And it keeps me from confronting my own prejudices and my own biases. It allows me to ignore my own privilege and complicity in oppressive systems. Vilifying another keeps me from growing personally. And I want to grow. That's the same reason I watch Jersey Shore, by the way. It's just, it makes me feel better about myself. But I'm not growing. And I'm right that we need that moment of laughter for next week, or next service. I want to grow, you know? I want to evolve. I want to change. I want to move closer and closer to what it means to be a peacemaker. I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's this inward peacemaking that needs to occur. As vigilantly socially critical that I can become, I also need to be equally self-critical. And I've wondered that in my pursuit of social justice, is it a way of ignoring my own private suffering? Because I know a lot of people that travel in the circles of social justice as I do, and I've met a lot of really unhappy people. And could it be a sense of projecting because I keep looking for something that's worse off than me because I don't want to address what's happening inside? So I'll just keep chasing after and fighting for, and it keeps me from addressing this inner peacemaking that needs to occur. I really think we're all doing the best we can with what we know. And I'd rather experience shalom than be a martyr. I don't want to end up old and bitter, you know? I'd so much rather be gentle and childlike. Jesus makes this thing that he's like, what's he say? He goes, to be wise as a serpent and gentle as a dove. And I've concluded that if I had to pick one, like, may I be gentle as a dove. If I had to pick. I'm not saying that, like, there's a sense of, I don't want to be naive, because that would be childish. I want to be childlike. And I wonder if that's why Jesus connects these two ideas. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Because children are really great at believing stories. A few weeks ago, Laura and I, we got in an argument. And the boys were like overhearing it, you know? And it wasn't like, you know, no one's throwing dishes or anything, but we're arguing over something stupid. And but then in the process of that argument, the boys eventually spilled over to them going to bed, and so they went upstairs and went to bed. And we concluded the argument, but we've gotten into habit over the years of making sure if that kind of situation occurs to go upstairs and let them know how it ended. Because we think it's okay for them to hear us argue. That's our thing. We want them to see that conflict is not the absence of peace, right? That's how you usually get to peace, is going through those stages, right? But it's so important for them to hear how we ended it, because if they don't, I know that they'll make their own story up, and I would hate for them to ever think that we're, you know, mom and dad argued because of me. I don't want them going to sleep thinking that. So we go upstairs. We just made a habit of it. But what I'm always taken by is when the other night I snuck into Link's room and he's like getting ready to go to sleep. And I'm like, hey, I just want you to know how it ended. And mom and I, we figured it out. And I just want you to know it wasn't about you, buddy. We love each other and we love you. And this is what happened. And he's just like, okay, sounds good. Like, just You know, I was like over communicating it, like I kind of am right now. And he just was like, okay, sure. And I love that about children, because I think they're so quick to believe a true and better story. That ultimately, I guess what I'm trying to say is children are experts at hope. Like they're brilliant at it. So if I had to dare to rephrase this saying, I would say, blessed are the circle makers, for they will be called hopeful. Blessed are the circle makers, because they will hope. When we reach that fork in the road and the path towards nostalgia or resignation, we choose the path of reconciliation and peacemaking. And we choose to hope. Hope for our relationships, our country, our neighbors, our enemies, our oceans, our religions, the sexually assaulted, the hated, the oppressed, the oppressor, the refugee, and the exploited. And peacemaking, maybe at its core, is about inviting people into a true and better story. You've heard it said this, but now I'd like to tell you a better and more true story. That when you reach that fork in the road, whatever it is, with your coworkers or your significant other, or the environment, or your neighbor, or your enemy, that we do not default to the sense of resignation or nostalgia, but we decide to move forward and hope for a better way forward. Sound good? So how about we stand together, and I'll offer us a closing thought. Blessed are the circle makers, for they will be called hopeful. So may you go out and hope. You know, not in some naivete, but in a real childlike kind of way. Would you offer the world a true and better story? Would you desire a way forward that looks not like peace-seeking or peace-keeping, but the arduous road of peacemaking? And we'd celebrate our diversity amidst our unity and never settle for the easier road of uniformity. I love that about our community. And I love you. All right? Go and have a great day.